Hi, everyone. I'm Sunil Iyengar, Director of Research at the National Endowment for the Arts. I don't know if you've just come in or if you've been here all day, but if you've sat here throughout the day or even if you've just joined us for the last panel or two, you've probably girded yourself for the traditional hard-boiled language of economics, by which I mean dollars and cents. I'm asking you now to take a bit of a leap with me and to consider economics in light of its origins in political philosophy as a set of conscious choices about consumption, production, and distribution. In short, I'm going to ask you for the purpose of this interview to shift from thinking about economic growth per se to economic well-being. Every now and then throughout the day, we've heard economists acknowledge that income, revenue, expenditures, and even job growth may not be the only or even the optimal way of thinking about the arts' value to individuals and society. What about non-monetary measures, such as time, which is a finite commodity for most of us, one that we're obliged to budget and appropriate? In that connection, I just want to quickly mention three initiatives. One is the NEA, through our research office, has been putting a lot of emphasis lately on studying what's called the American Time Use Survey, which is a data set maintained, some of you know, by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Department of Labor. And we hope later this month, or I believe in a few weeks, to release data on state use, what certain states, what we see the range of time use behavior to be. As another sort of, and this is really the province of economists as well. And to go a step further, another way to think about the sort of non-monetary measures is the value that people place on the time they spend. So the NEA, for example, is conducting a series of audience impact surveys of grantee projects to measure affect in the sense of psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who talks about the flow concept when people lose their sense of time completely in service to a larger goal or project. Third brings us to our topic now, our interest in surveys of well-being or happiness in general. The NEA is part of a 15-agency member task force called the Interagency Task Force on the Arts and Human Development. It's one of the things we've been talking a lot about is the use of subjective well-being measures and, indeed, happiness studies. This is a field where Carol Graham, who's with us here today, is preeminent. Carol Graham, I'm very happy to introduce, is a senior fellow and Charles Robinson Chair at the Brookings Institution and College Park Professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. She's the author of numerous books, including The Pursuit of Happiness and The Pursuit of Happiness with the subtitle Toward an Economy of Well-Being and Happiness Around the World, The Paradox of Happy Peasants and Miserable Millionaires. I've really enjoyed reading them. She's also currently serving on a National Academy of Science, National Academies panel, which is assessing the relevance of well-being metrics for policy, and that's actually where I had the pleasure to meet her. The NEA, we had the chance to speak with that panel, and they're doing some great work, which we can probably hear a little bit about now. Born in Lima, Peru, Graham has an AB from Princeton University, an MA from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a PhD from Oxford University. Hope that wasn't mine. Okay. Well, it's one of us. Probably mine. Okay. So I will take off my phone, clearly, just in case it's that, and we'll go straight to you. What we thought we'd do is have kind of a conversational flow, an interview, and we'll certainly leave time for questions. This conference is focused, as I said, on largely monetary measures of the arts' ability to influence lives, neighborhoods, towns, and cities in our nation. Can you explain a little bit more about why happiness is a subject for economists and not solely psychologists or behavioral health experts?
Okay. Well, thanks, Sunil. I think trying to answer the question in relevance to economics more generally and then also to the arts, the economics of happiness is a relatively new field. It's the world is our oyster in lots of ways in terms of how we can use well-being surveys to measure the welfare effects of all kinds of things that standard economics approaches don't capture very well, in the sense that standard economics relies on consumption choices as revealed preferences, as the data that they use to evaluate what people value. But all of us know that there's some consumption choices that are perverse or irrational, such as those that result from addiction and self-control problems, obesity, cigarette smoking, whatever it might be, or when people don't have choice because of very strong norms, discrimination, high levels of poverty. So you can't, there are things that you miss if you're only looking at consumption choices. And then there are also people live under institutional arrangements, governance arrangements, in economic conditions that may affect their well-being, but they can't really reveal a preference. You know, I think I always give the example of a poor peasant who lives in Bolivia and is made unhappy by inequality. Well, short of emigrating or protesting, both of which are very extreme choices, there's no way for this peasant to reveal the welfare effects of inequality. But with well-being surveys, we can measure the welfare effects of all kinds of things, of commuting time on well-being, of governance arrangements, of environmental quality, of participation in different activities, including the arts. We haven't done that, but that's an area that would be, I think, open for this analysis. And then, in true economist sense, we can also actually quantify these effects in relative income terms. So it's, and we only do that to give them, people will always want to know the relative orders of magnitudes of things, so we can compare, for example, the effects of being unemployed, how much does it cost well-being as opposed to, you know, a salary of X, or an income loss of X. But really the income measures of it all are less important than the relative weights that we can attach to these things. So, for example, commuting time makes people less happy. Good health makes people much more happy, and on and on.
Yeah, and actually that's something that struck me, and I think it's a theme in your work, just to unpack it a bit about revealed preferences. When you talk about revealed preferences, you mean essentially the agency of choice to spend, and right, consumer spending, for example, which is often seen as the way of measuring value, and you're suggesting then that in certain situations that the agency of choice is not an option, or isn't, is that correct?
Absolutely. Either choice is not an option because people don't have means, or they don't have information, or their norms that dictate their choice. Think of somebody in a lower caste in India where it's a very strong norm that not only are you in a lower caste, you'll stay in a lower caste. And you look at a decision about whether or not to send a child to school under those circumstances, is that really a choice? I mean, there isn't agency there. So you know, understanding the behavior can't only be illuminated by the choice or lack thereof. In other instances, and very often, I think, in our society, where we have a lot of prosperity and a lot of consumption choices, and a lot of consumption choices seem to be driven by keeping up with the Joneses or by marketing or by other things, not all of which are bad, but they often can lead to bad choices. And one of the things that we find in this whole area, and one of the nice and most interesting things about this whole area of economics is that we do actually work with and learn from psychologists every day, and that's a wonderful thing. But one of the things that we also have learned is that people often mispredict. So they will think that a very large expenditure on a new car, you know, a fancy new car, will make them very happy. Well, it turns out it does the day they bought it, and every now and then they look at the new car. But usually when they're driving, they could be driving a VW Bug, and it wouldn't make a difference. You know, in other words, there's a big misprediction. So people think that material goods will enhance their well-being, and yet what we find in the empirical work, not just in the U.S. but around the world, is that the basic determinants of happiness are things like good health, stable partnerships, friendships, having meaningful activities, so meaningful work. I don't have data on participation in the arts, but it fits into that realm of activities, which is it is about being purposeful and active and productive, but it isn't necessarily about income alone.
Right. And actually, could you expand on, I know that there's a paradox of sorts. I mean, it's in your title about the way that income has been equated with happiness across different countries. And isn't it true that, at least in a lot of the research, upward mobility, and again, getting back to the agency of choice, seems to be a lot more associated with happiness, positive subjective well-being measures?
Well, here the whole issue of not having agency and having agency is where there is a puzzle. And the paradox of happy peasants and miserable millionaires was originally, in my original work, the paradox of happy peasants and frustrated achievers. And there are several dimensions of well-being. There's well-being as simple contentment, and you can think of it in the Benthamite sense. There's a chapter in my latest book called Should Bentham or Aristotle Be in the Census Bureau? But you know, Benthamite happiness is basically the greatest contentment for the greatest number of all people. Aristotelian happiness is people's capacity and ability to lead a fulfilling life, in addition to having enough means. And when we look around the world, we find often that, or even within the U.S., you can find very poor people with low expectations without the agency of choice who can report to be content with day-to-day life. And that's probably a good thing from an individual psychological perspective, just to be able to adapt to adversity and sort of value daily life and take contentment in. Then we find that people with more means, and income proxies for means, but really more means means more education, more choices, more opportunities to lead a fulfilling life, are happier on both dimensions of well-being, both contentment and Aristotelian well-being. But when people are in the process of trying to acquire agency, when you look at, for example, I've done a lot of work on migrants, people who have chosen to migrate from a poor country to a wealthier country, to make their lives better or make their children's lives better. Or when you look at upwardly mobile people in rapidly growing, developing countries like China or Peru, where I'm from, when you see people who are making big changes, maybe have migrated from rural to urban areas, have made big income gains, they're typically not very happy. And what we don't know and are trying to disentangle is whether it's that making those major life changes requires some frustration and unhappiness, or whether the process of change is necessarily unsettling. And we're starting to get at this and have some sense of it. What we do know from a lot of research is that, in general, people cannot adapt to uncertainty. They can adapt better to unpleasant certainty than they can to uncertainty. So you see societies caught in bad equilibriums, lots of poverty, bad health, sort of complacent about it. And it takes some kind of change to shift, to acquire agency or a better life, and that shift is usually not a happy process.
So I was hoping that, just a couple more questions that I'd love to open it up, for this group here, if you could think about, if you could explain to them where sort of the field is of happiness research has kind of connected with policy now abroad and here, in some of the work you're doing, you know, with the Academy, National Academies, and just maybe even speculate on where you see the arts in that mix.
Okay, well, one of the things that's been remarkable from my perspective, because 10 years ago, if you said you worked on happiness to a group of economists, they looked at you like you were certified nuts and were about to grow horns or something. And now it's not, even in mainstream economics, there are just thousands of articles a year with happiness in the title or using happiness surveys. So it's become a much more, and that has resulted in, I think, enough people refining the metrics that we have a robust measurement science, and that's an exciting thing. And as a result of that, I think there's an interest in using these metrics in policy. I think another driver of that interest, and that interest ranges from the British government putting well-being metrics into its statistics already, to the UN General Assembly having a meeting in April about should well-being be a 9th millennium development goal, the Sen Sarkozy Commission on well-being measures in general for sort of measuring development process or policies around the world. So there's been, I think, a shifting also of priorities, perhaps in part due to the global economic crisis, in a sense that the model we had before failed in some way. People are grasping for something else, and maybe the moment was right for well-being metrics, but in any event, there's a lot of receptivity to should we be using these metrics in policy. And in the case of the United States, which is moving much more cautiously and much more skeptically, indeed there was a Wall Street Journal article 2 days ago basically bashing the work of the panel and saying that now the government was going to get in the business of telling people how to be happy, which is not at all what this is about. But you can imagine this is, it's a new topic and it's ripe for criticism. But I think what we're trying to do in the policy realm is to introduce metrics, or to think about how best to introduce metrics that can measure these two dimensions of well-being, how people spend their daily lives. Are they content? What's their quality of life as they go through these experiences, the daily experience kind of well-being, which I've roughly called benthamite. And then how do people evaluate their lives as a whole? What kind of opportunities do they have? How do those evaluations track with the choices they have in their lives and the kinds of lives they lead? And then ultimately, what, if anything, do either of these two dimensions of well-being cause? Do they cause behaviors of interest? So some of the work I've done shows that well-being or happiness is contentment doesn't really cause anything, but well-being in terms of sort of in the more life evaluation sense seems to be associated with better performance in the labor market, more productivity, better health, more investments in one's own future. If you think you're going to have an opportunity in the future, you're more likely to invest in it. So the policy discussions at this point, at least in the U.S. and in the panel, are very much along the lines of, you know, which metrics are tractable, what could we really incorporate into our statistics, what constitutes a meaningful change in one of these metrics, because one thing is research, another is policy, and then we need metrics that are easily tractable, easily understandable, and that can be followed across people and over time in a fairly simple way. The British government has simply incorporated four questions into its statistics as an experiment. One is, generally speaking, how satisfied are you with your life, and a life evaluation. A question which tries to measure positive experiences on a daily basis, how happy were you yesterday? A question which tries to measure negative experiences, how anxious were you yesterday? And then a question about do you have purpose or meaning in your life? And the experience questions are not just about daily experience. They track with things we care a lot about. For example, people who report to have worried a lot yesterday in the United States are much more likely to not have health insurance or to have a health condition. So how we balance the weight we give to how people experience their daily lives and the relevance of that to policy versus how people have the choice to lead more fulfilling lives, which also has relevance to policy. What's the right balance is really what's on the table as a question now.
And then finally, has your research shown anything about the arts? I mean, it's not so much about arts, but about social capital, say, because that's something that the arts often will talk about. People in doing research in the arts talk about the whether it's social cohesion or volunteer rates or some sense of affinity with others. Is that something that you track by virtue of any cultural activities or any?
Well, there's the findings are robust and consistent that participation in social activities is, from a daily experience sense, one of the most important times of the day for most people, and from a life evaluation sense, also very important. There's some studies that show that altruistic people are happier. There's even a study on religion in Europe where religion is a moderate force. Any of the religious findings break down where religion is a divisive force. But that not only are religious people happier than non-religious people, but that even atheists are happier when they live in religious neighborhoods. And so what does that have to do? That has to do with the social capital,
yes,
component of it all. And so if you think about that set of findings, again, I haven't done anything directly in the arts, and you think about the importance to people's overall life satisfaction and life evaluations of participating in meaningful work, it's a no-brainer to imagine that the arts, participation in the arts, both because of the individual fulfillment that it can give and also the community that often brings with it, is likely to be associated with higher levels of well-being. That's, you know, it would be great. If you happen to have any NEA funding, we'll do a study for you. But
I'll pretend I didn't hear that. Actually, that's we'll talk. Yeah, we'll talk. Yes, exactly. My boss is in the front row. Couple of things I just want to mention, and then I'll turn it over. We were talking largely about, if you'll notice, about policy and in connection to this, but in fact, companies, as far as I know. There's some employers who are also very interested in this issue, so the private sector seems to be, to some extent, interested. I don't know if they would fund studies, too. But, you know, as you know, the Gallup World Poll and some of these actually have clients among industries that are interested in understanding. They do a nightly survey of well-being, and they get, you know, I think it's a few hundred each.
Thousand a day.
Thousand a day. Yeah. There you go. And so it's a pretty large group over time. And I think that that could potentially appeal to a broader group than I think just public policymakers, I would hope. And the other thing is, in terms of arts research, there is a study some of you may have seen reported in the popular press. There was a Norwegian study actually done last year, reported last year by the British Medical Association, where it was something like 100,000 or so people, as only the Norwegians can do, where they looked at happiness. Well, actually, they looked at cultural participation in terms of active cultural participation versus what they called receptive, so sort of differentiating between creating and observing art, and the relationship in men and women with well-being. And I think that was a very interesting study, which I'd be happy to talk about later if you'd like.
What can you summarize the
general terms? Yeah, general terms, it was interesting in terms of the gender differences. There was actually, I think it was like men were more highly correlated with reported self-reported well-being measures independently when they observed art, and not so much for women, apparently. I have to go back and look, but I think the men were, there was much more association with men observing art, and I don't mean just visual, you know, like taking part in what they called a receptive way. It's an interesting study, and I think it was published in a large epidemiological journal. So that's the kind of work that's being done abroad, some of it anyway. I know it's very limited. So for Carol, any questions? Oh, sure.
Yes.
You could say your name and affiliation.
Okay. Hi, I'm Fred Altman, and I have a rather far-fetched question. There's a correlation between happiness and immune function and health outcome. And so, instead of talking about the monetary effects of the arts, how about what might be the relationship between health and having arts available?
Well, I can't answer that directly, but I certainly I know of several studies that find a relationship between happiness and longevity, happiness and better health. We know that better health makes people happier, but we also know that happier people live longer and are typically healthier. There are all kinds of reasons for that. My read of all the data, including my own, is that part of it is just that a better attitude helps you manage any kind of chronic disease. It probably won't cure cancer, but for a lot of conditions, a good attitude gets people through. There seems to be a kind of spillover effect. So we find, for example, that if you're of a certain income level and if people around you have higher levels of income, that typically decreases your reported happiness or well-being because of some human envy effect or whatever it might be. But if you are around happier people, you're actually happier. There's a positive spillover effect, and I think that fits, that flows over into the health channel or dealing with health problems channel. And so whatever is going on in that relationship would likely, I can imagine, you could draw yet another line in terms of participation in the arts or, the same way that, meaningful activities. And that probably with the arts in particular, there are these kind of positive spillover effects that could probably be good for friendships, health, and all of those other, not yet well established, but certainly existing channels between higher levels of well-being and better health.
You've spoken mostly about the effect of arts on happiness, the effect of arts on happiness of the community. I'm wondering about the effect of how artists are happy. And I wonder if you can just think about the manner in which artists, arts organizers, and dare I say arts researchers might characterize their happiness or how it might be qualitatively different from or similar to the kinds of happiness that people who aren't involved in the arts experience.
Okay, let me try and answer you in two ways. One is just typical economist blunt tool saying, you know, we're not going to say anything unless we can establish a real effect. And the way we would do that would be to, you know, have one of our standard regressions with happiness on the left-hand side and all of these control variables, age, income, gender, marital status, and we'd put in a what we call a dummy variable for whether you're an artist or not. And if you had enough artists and enough different categories of artists, we could even categorize them and see if they were controlling for all these other things, you know, happier than the rest. So then you probably could find an effect. And so that's kind of one, you know, very sort of kind of metric-y answer. A second one, though, stems from everything that we know about the determinants of well-being. So we know that income matters to well-being in the sense that being destitute is bad for well-being or happiness, and having more means and therefore more choices that come with that is good for well-being. But we also know that after certain levels of income, more and more income don't make people happier. We know that people who pursue that place sort of excessive emphasis on material goals versus other goals are less happy. We know that people that participate or perceive to have meaningful work or to do meaningful work or to be appreciated at work for what they do are more productive than those that don't. We know that a very less well-defined component of this life evaluation kind of well-being has to do with having purpose or meaning in your life. You know, you could put artists in probably all those categories. It would suggest that probably artists, and they've chosen to be artists, so they've made a choice, you know, they've made a conscious choice in their lives, and most of them knowing that they're probably not going to be millionaires. So the likelihood is that they're probably pretty happy on, you know, compared to the average guy, but I, you know.
You could put in a dummy variable for, are they blues musicians? Because then.
But I like blues.
Blues musicians are really happy.
We
have
a little bit of sad.
And lute players. All right. Hi, I'm Ximena Varela. I'm Associate Professor of Arts Management at American University. A lot of the work that I've done has been with arts and culture organizations in Latin America and extremely impoverished communities and in zones of conflict. And what I've found is that in those areas, what people hold on to most are the arts and their artistic expression when everything else is gone. Right? So there's no place to live. Whatever, their songs remain, stories remain, some kind of artistic production remains. So I'm looking for this connection between what you're saying about well-being and the arts. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you know about happiness among people who really should be really miserable and what that's like. So happiness in zones of conflict, happiness in war, and happiness in extreme poverty.
Okay, well, I know a lot about happiness and extreme poverty, and I'm from Peru, which is, I have to say, one of the richest sort of artistic handicrafts traditions in Latin America, as well as cuisines. So it's a culture that values art in lots of different expressions. I did the first study of happiness in Afghanistan, a pilot study, not in the very violent zones, but and so what we find is that people who are in very poor situations typically can be surprisingly content from a kind of simple, how happy are you with your life sense, kind of how content are you, how happy were you yesterday sense. This doesn't apply to conflict because conflict typically is pretty awful. I mean, it's hard to say that people in conflict are well off. But if you ask those same people in these very destitute situations who report to be okay, content, they may even be more content than the average person in a more privileged situation. But if you ask them, there's this one question we use, which is called, "What's the best possible life you can imagine?" On a 10-step ladder, where the best possible life is 10 and the worst possible life is 1, where would you place your own life compared to the best possible life? We ask the same people that question, and they'll score much lower than somebody who's more privileged. So I think this is part of this human capacity to adapt to adversity and preserve psychological well-being and health, and to do so in ways that are possible. And, you know, if there's a strong artistic tradition capability, that's, you know, that's going to matter a lot.
Exactly. And I'm wondering then, if it isn't the artistic capability or tradition that a lot, that is the key then to that sustained well-being, or could be one of the keys?
It could be one of the keys. When we look across Latin America and looked at the most important variables to the happiness or well-being of the rich and the poor, roughly defined, the rich being above median income, the poor being below median income, so it's not really the rich and the poor, but people with means, people without means is what it breaks down to. We find that the most important variables to the well-being of the poor after having enough food to eat are friends and family they can rely on at times of need. The most important variables to the well-being of the rich are their work and their health. Now, you could conclude that the rich are greedy jerks, they don't care about their friends, but I don't think that's what's going on. What's going on is, I mean, the rich still value their friends. They, you know, they come, that the, for the rich, work and health are their agency, their ability to control their lives and do what they want. For the poor, in a region where there aren't good safety nets, where life is very, you know, can be very vulnerable and unpredictable, friends and family are the safety nets. You know, we didn't have a variable for the arts, but one could imagine that the arts could be, you know, an outlet that the poor have to lead in difficult situations, to lead more meaningful lives, right? To put those, but again, I'm only conjecturing here.
I think we can take one more question, Steve.
Much of the work you've discussed has implied comparison between rich and poor and explicitly made them, but have you sort of calculated a Gini index of happiness? I mean, and how is that trending? So do you have some sense of the nature of inequality in happiness levels and how that's evolving?
That's a very good question. We also have quite a bit of work on how inequality affects happiness, which is a slightly different question. That's more easily answered than your question because it has a lot to do with what inequality signals. If it signals injustice, it makes people unhappy. If it doesn't, it signals opportunity, they don't mind it. The inequality of happiness question is... We know, you know, there's some distribution of happiness, and we know that there are always more very happies among the rich than among the poor because of just, you know, real environmental reasons. But that distribution is also just driven by something I often call the curmudgeon effect, right? You know, you think about everybody you know, and there are people that are natural curmudgeons or people that are naturally happy all the time, and so that distribution of character traits, which also goes across populations, is a pretty normal distribution, affects your distribution of happiness. So the asymmetry in happiness is less than the asymmetry in income across populations, for sure. There's also a wonderful study by a colleague of mine in France about asymmetry in happiness among couples. So it's called "You Can't Be Happier Than Your Wife," and what it finds is that it predicts the probability of divorce is highest when there's asymmetry in happiness levels. So it's better to have two happy people married to each other or two unhappy people married to each other, but you don't want a happy person and an unhappy person married to each other. So anyway, that's there.
Thank you very, very much, Carol. Please give a hand to Carol. I just want to say that a couple things. One is I was just upstairs and there's an exhibit to Robert Brookings, you know, and it has, among other things, his prized violin, a picture of his prized violin that he played, and his passion. It talks about his passion for music. And I just realized, you know, I just got in there to use the restroom, and I'm like, the arts are really inescapable. I mean, in that sense, and in the sense, what our goal has been is to make arts research really, I think, inescapable in terms of a factor to be dealt with in culture, in economics broadly, and I really thank the speakers for that. for helping us along that lines. And I also wanted to mention that another reason I thought of the word inescapable, because I realized when we were talking back there, you mentioned that your uncle was the designer of Sears Tower. So it was like yet another connection to the arts. So thank you all. I want to just also, Michael Rushton's going to come up, I believe, and say a few words. I just want to close this out. But wanted to thank Bruce Katz, the Brookings Institution, Rocco, Joan, my colleagues, Ellen Grantham, for doing a lot of the planning and heavy lifting of this conference, and Carolyn Spector, and the whole host of NEA volunteers who've helped us out, and, of course, the speakers. So thanks again, and thank you, Carol.
Okay, well, thank you, Cindy. I'll just a few words in closing. A couple of observations that weren't actually things that weren't apparent to me as we built up to the symposium, but that really became clear yesterday with the meeting of the authors and today in the presentations, is that an interesting complexity in the subject of the arts, new growth theory, and economic development. When we selected papers, you know, Sunil and I worked together to, you know, select papers for the symposium. You know, we thought, well, okay, who's doing interesting things? Who's doing interesting work that we'd really like to have presented here? But what came about is almost sort of a happy accident is a nice complementarity amongst all of the work we had that actually illustrates what's necessary to look at a subject like this. We've had presentations today that really get inside the heads of artists and engineers and so on, and how they think about creativity and design, up to entrepreneurs at both the individual artist level, nonprofit entrepreneurs in commercial galleries, and then as we build up from there, going to studies of city blocks, to neighborhoods, to small towns, to big cities, to metropolitan areas, to larger regions. And we've actually looked at this subject from all these different levels, and we had to. You could not have a full understanding of the subject only looking at it at one level. And so it's great that we were able to bring together all of these different perspectives to try to gain some insight into this. The second thing I really noticed from this is that a lot of the work that we saw today from the presenters is really great original stuff. I mean, if you think of the 10 years since Richard Florida's book on the rise of the creative class was published, it seems to me it's taken a while for work to really take off in terms of getting into the weeds of really trying to figure out what's going on here between the arts and creativity and economic development. And here we had really great original research that really tries to take apart these very difficult problems of what direction is the causality and the complexity of these networks and so on. So some real advances there. But the other thing that comes through in these papers is there's so much more we could do. This is just getting started. There are just these terrific green fields out there for new research in this. I would say to any graduate student out there who happens to be listening, boy, you know, you've got tremendous amount of stuff that can be done here. There are data sets out there. There are questions out there. There is so much that can be done. And so this is just a great opportunity for young researchers to really get into this field, to take some of the studies that you've heard from today, try to build upon them, to look internationally. I mean, you have so many emerging arts markets and emerging cities around the world where these very same questions are going to be coming up, and lots of opportunity to look into it there. So I would like to thank all of the presenters for bringing their new research to this conference, to working on fairly tight timelines to put together fairly significant pieces of research and presentations from which we've received so much benefit. And a final thing to say is that in Ed Glaser's talk, he talked about the importance of cities as things that reduce distance, all the advantages that come from being face-to-face with one another rather than sort of imagining that everything can be done by telecommuting. And that really that really comes through when you come to a conference, right? Because, I mean, why are we all here in the same room? We come from all these different places. Well, we come here because there are all those benefits to seeing each other face-to-face, to being able to talk about these things, to have conversations over coffee and in the Q&A, to see each other's work, and to really come together that way. It's so much more can be done by bringing people together than simply saying, well, I wrote a paper here, I'll email it to you and you can have a look. I mean, we get so much more out of this. And so great thanks to the National Endowment for the Arts, to Rocco Landsman, to Joan, Sunil, Ellen, all the people at the National Endowment who brought this together, to everybody at Brookings who came to host this terrific event to publicize it. We were just overjoyed with the amount of response that we got to this. It's been a terrific event. Thank you very much, and I think that's it. Okay.